This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Our guest today is Terry Goddard, former Phoenix mayor, attorney general of the state of Arizona, and the foremost practitioner of the art of citizen petition passing, at least maybe until the Red for Ed people came along and amazed everybody.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that acknowledgement. I think there's no greater opportunity for a citizen to exercise this democracy than through the petition process.
Well, your first one was like 1980, if I recall.
That's about right. We had a gas tax. I started with a gas tax petition that was a referendum, state referendum. And then after that, I went directly into the petition that changed the way Phoenix elected its city council from at large to districts.
How do you feel how that's worked out, by the way?
I think it's basically worked out well. Changes in government never quite go the way you may have predicted. I thought there would be even more neighborhood assistance through the district council. I think it's probably time now to think about having a few more districts. Because they've gotten so large. I mean, Phoenix
What about having a couple at large?
I think that's a good idea.
That was Dave Houston Tierney's proposal, I remember at the time thinking, maybe later, but not initially.
Yeah, that was my thought, too. And Houston has a situation where they have two at large, and then they have, I think, 8 or 10 districts and a mayor. And that works, I think, extremely well because the two at large are sort of vice mayors. They have permanent committee assignments. And the others have district obligations, which are what you want from a council person. So I basically think it's worked out well, but could be better, could be a little more directly connected to the citizens. And at large would be a good way to combine the citywide vision with the district representation.
And every reform begets the basis of the next one. I'm thinking of things like when we had the 51% requirement. You were involved.
I got hit by that one. Right. Yeah. Everybody thought this will never happen. We'll never have an election.
Because we had just elected Ebb Meacham with 39% of the vote. And we said, well, we need a majority.
50% plus one. And, between Fife Symington and me, 2%
candidate.
We didn't quite make it. Yeah. And so there was a runoff that nobody had planned for. Yeah.
And of course, I think you could make a case for, but it's very hard to justify something like a 45% threshold, which absolutely is an arbitrary number. Could be 46, could be 44, whatever. But the point is, all right, maybe if there's a third party candidate who has a trivial number of votes, it doesn't have to be majority. But 39% is clearly not enough.
We won't make it. Yep.
And it was amazing how quickly after that. So we implement the change to make it 51%. And then we have
election.
A virtual tie election.
Next election.
And you run two elections in tandem with essentially the same results.
Pretty much. Yeah. You always hope that you'll be able to change. But we just saw that again in the Phoenix mayor's race where the results of the primary were almost identical to the general.
Well, except in that case, you weren't just taking out 2% of the vote; you were taking out a lot. I mean, in your case,
case, we were tied.
Yeah, yeah. So in your case, it was 50. It was 49.9 to 49.8, and you both went up by a couple of fractions. That outcome was probably less predictable.
Yep, I agree.
Dirty money, third try.
Well, it is in a way. It's a third try.
Take us through the history of that.
Who's counting?
I'm counting. Let's go back. In the two prior tries, I think it's very instructive what happened. And if we could walk through what.
Well, I've certainly learned a lot. Yeah. I don't know if anybody else has. But we started this process. I feel very passionately that anonymous campaign funds don't belong in a democracy, it's important to stand up for what you believe, and it's important to put your name at the bottom line if you're going to buy an advertisement.
Well, we've had one vote on that in the city of Tempe, and 91% of the voters agreed with you on that one.
They absolutely did, and Phoenix had a vote on it too, and 85% agreed. Mm-hmm. So I think I can say very confidently this is a popular program. Transparency makes sense to people regardless of their political orientation. It's just the way it ought to be.
So the only way those who are against this, in my judgment, are going to stop this is to keep you off the ballot.
That's right. I think once we get on the ballot, we're we're not home free and never are in politics, but I think we've got a very strong popular sentiment. The thing that surprises
I've never seen 85 or 91% on anything.
Putin doesn't get those numbers. So it's close to unanimous. And when we pass the petitions, believe me, that's the response we get. People literally take them out of the volunteers' hands and say, I want to sign. I want to get rid of this. It's an abomination. And by that, I mean the dark money, the anonymous contributions that end up being hidden and then going into political campaigns, supporting or opposing candidates. What happened in history was back in 2016, we had a proposition. I was worked very hard and we ran it together with something Paul Johnson was working on, which was to try to empower independents better and with an open primary, a California-style primary, where it was basically a runoff instead of a partisan nomination. And they had some funding. They had some funding out of a billionaire in Texas. And the billionaire, it turned out, and they thought, well, disclosure is really popular. A top two primary is hard to explain, and so it's not so popular. So why don't we join the two together, have two companion propositions, and we'll get it on the ballot and run as a team.
And political reform.
Let's open up state government in Arizona, and I thought that was a good proposition, and I went along. And then the billionaire found out that we were talking about disclosing all funders, and we got a very sheepish call from his chief of staff, which says, well, he does a lot of the secret funding, and we really don't feel it would be consistent if we sponsored your proposition. So they withdrew the money. And that took us out in 2016. In 2018, we had no such illusions. We didn't have any billionaire support. We learned our
lesson. Decided to do it the hard way. We're going to do this with volunteers.
Do it the hard way with volunteers and with a few paid petition passers. And that's where we came a cropper of the Supreme Court. They basically validated both a statute and a process that I think they shouldn't have, frankly.
Which were, frankly, put in to make it hard for folks like you.
What they did was they said a paid petition passer has to register with the Secretary of State. So good so far. I mean, we all want to have controls on this process. And the deal is if they get served later to come and the subpoena is served at that address, the one they gave the Secretary of State, and they don't show up, then the penalty is all the signatures that they gathered will be stricken. And that's where I really parted company with the statute, because we have a constitutional right to petition our government. And the fact that the person gathering the signatures for some reason didn't do something should not invalidate our constitutional right. But the Supreme Court went ahead and said, yes, it does. And they also validated an amazing subpoena process. In other words, many of the out-of-state petition passers simply gave the address of their employer, which was an office on Central Avenue. And so the subpoenas were dropped off there, but they weren't given to a person that had any authority. They were given to the security guard on the weekend. And then they said, oh, we served. Well, they did not. That was ridiculous. We never heard that those petitions had been served. We never had a chance to try to find these people and get them to the hearing. So the result was about 10,000 signatures got stricken off, and the Supreme Court said, oh, that's okay. So I respectfully disagree. And that's where we sort of sat back and figured, well, now what can we do? And our volunteers were the ones that turned the tide for me. I was very disappointed, very depressed.
And you were like 90% volunteer signature.
Yes, we
as
were.
I recall,
we
the paid ones were just a little.
That was a very small amount, but it was the vulnerability.
Yes.
Because it was the paid ones that were challenged. Our volunteers, I just can't say this often enough. Our volunteers had a 92% validity rate.
This was up there. Red had about the same experience.
Yeah, but we were much better.
Were you even better than
our volunteers
them?
Were even better than theirs.
And theirs were really good.
They were really good.
Both of
really
you,
good.
I think, broke the record for good signatures.
Volunteers don't have any reason to – in fact, they'll be sometimes over-cautious with the sign. Oh, I'm sorry. You did that wrong. You got to do it again. Yeah. I've heard that so many times because they want the petition signature to count. And
I remember what the story, what you got, and I think it was around 250,000 signatures, wasn't it? You were right up around
little,
the edge.
285,000.
With volunteers.
Plus a few.
And then you're concerned about, because you know they're always going to throw some out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're usually 20% is the margin of error that you have to,
which is reasonable with paid people.
Well, it actually turned out to be a little low for paid people, but it was way high for volunteers because our volunteers only had 8% bad signatures. And frankly, I think I disputed the Secretary of State on that number. It should have been even higher. It should have been even better.
We'll pick this up in a moment in the Think Tank with Terry Goddard.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here with Terry Goddard talking about dark money and the mechanisms of getting stuff on the ballot. It's pretty clear to me what the legislature is trying to do. They're trying to stymie citizen initiatives.
Absolutely.
And you know that with paid people, which I think they pretty much knocked out now, the problem is they get this subpoena. But if you consider for a moment the kind of person who ends up being a paid partition gatherer, these are often people who move around a lot and are just hard to track down. And when they get a subpoena to come into court, it's just so easy to toss it.
Well, in this case, none of them got the subpoena. I mean, to give it to a security guard on the weekend, you have no legitimate expectation that those people you're subpoenaing are ever going to hear about it. Mm.
And the courts thought that is okay.
Oh, and by the way, you keep it a secret from the people that are passing the petition, so they don't have a chance to go out. I never had a chance to go out and try to find these people. Mm. So even if we could have found them, we never had the chance to do it. The first time we heard that they had tried to pass that petition, they gave us an early draft. They said, maybe we'll do this. And so we kept an eye out, and we thought, well, if they actually try to serve people, then they'll tell us.
And handing it to a security guard?
Handing to a security guard.
Constituted legal service?
On the weekend. Well, you see, we never got to challenge that in court because had we had any kind of, even a day before that they tried this, we would have brought the security guard in and say, okay, what's your authority? Did your tenant say that they were okay with you accepting service of process? And the answer, of course, would have been no. Mm-hmm. But we never had the chance to make that case before the judge.
Why not?
Because they kept it a secret. Mm-hmm. This is about dark money, remember. Wow. These are the people that are paid by a group called Americans for Progress? Yeah.
It's got some funny name.
It's a funny name. But anyway, it's a national
good government
organization.
Or whatever. Yeah.
The idea is to hide the ball.
Yeah.
And they certainly did it in their court process. So there's nothing new there.
So you have a somewhat larger, because the number you have to get is a function of how many people voted in the last election. We just had a really big election with high turnout. So your requirement numbers are up.
Yeah, the turnout in the 2018 election was almost a million higher than it was in 2014.
Which raises the bar for
you. Which means our number is based on a percentage of the people who voted for governor. Mm-hmm. So instead of 225,000, our minimum number is 357,000. That's a big hill to climb. I think we're up to it. It's never been done. It's brand new.
Until 2 or 3 years ago, that would have been regarded as an impossible threshold. Just like everybody believed until Red for Ed that you couldn't run an initiative campaign on volunteers.
Well, that was SOS. So let's get the...
Yeah. You're right. You're right.
The Save Our Schools were the ones that everybody poo-pooed. They said, no way are these bunch of
We had them in
teachers.
Here. We said the same. We said the same thing. We said, boy, these are really good people. They have no idea what they're in for. And they proved everybody wrong.
And they nailed it. They absolutely nailed it. I mean, they showed what passionate people can do. And our model, I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm looking to another state, in this case, Michigan. 2 years ago in Michigan, a couple of people decided that they wanted to put an end to gerrymandering in their state. They were sick and tired of obviously screwed up legislative districts. Well, that's a pretty technical issue. And what they did was they posted, I think, a Facebook statement saying, are you tired of gerrymandering? Let me know. And they got over 300 responses to that first pitch. They called a meeting in somebody's kitchen. And 30 or 40 people showed up, and out of that, they grew one of the most powerful citizens' movements I've ever heard of. They had 6,000 volunteers. They got 450,000 signatures. They didn't pay a single person. And the bottom line is it can be done. People are really energized today. They want to do something that they think will make a significant difference in how our government is operating. I mean, they understand it's screwed up. They understand we've made some serious problems, and I think a lot of people feel if they have a chance to fix it, they want to take that chance, and passing this petition is a way to do it.
I did some simple arithmetic with the SOS thing. They had 5,000 people on their Facebook page. I said, if you had 5,000 people, they got 30 signatures apiece, that's 150,000,
bingo,
which was what they needed at the time. Now, your threshold's a little larger than that, but if I think the power to me of social media is you can get those 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 people together in a way that you couldn't before.
Absolutely.
Without great difficulty.
And if people would go to outlawdirtymoney.com, you've got volunteer packets, you've got how to get a petition, you've got all of the information that you would need to be able to activate your citizenship, to go out and actually change the way our elections are handled in Arizona.
Got any of the former SOS people involved in
that? Absolutely. We're very dependent on SOS and Red for Ed following up. They are now the most, I would say, well, it's hard to distinguish between groups of volunteers, but they are clearly highly motivated because here's what they see. They see as long as dirty money continues to be a major factor in Arizona elections, the people that support education reform are basically going to continue to play a rearguard action against the DeVos forces and others who just want to privatize the schools. And they're going to keep changing. It's a hydra-headed monster. It's going to keep coming back at them in different forms because they can do it, because they've got unlimited funds and they will form themselves into different dark money organizations. And they will just harass a citizens group to death. And so they feel unless we can get responsibility for these ads, unless we can nail down who is responsible— mm-hmm. We're going to continue to get hammered.
Which heretofore
they want to stop it.
Had been insider stuff most people didn't understand. I watched those folks came in here and talked to us afterwards. Their education came at 1 a.m. in the legislature when they watched all sorts of stuff that was being slipped into bills. God bless them. They didn't go home. And I remember my conclusion after that. I said, I think civics will never be taught quite the same in our high schools.
Well, absolutely not.
Okay, we'll be back with Terry Goddard talking all things related to electoral issues in the think tank. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Terry Goddard talking about dirty money. Sounds like something we shouldn't like, but why should we care?
Yeah, and we changed the name from dark money to dirty advisedly because it seemed that we didn't have much chance when you're meeting somebody on the street corner and you need a signature. I wanted to make there no doubt that this was something that we didn't approve of. Mm-hmm. Dark is ambiguous. Dirty is not. It's polluting. And I believe that's
it's secret money. It's money
secret
that comes in under the name of some very benign sounding organization that is funded by some often very unbenign organization.
Well, it's got a name, and this is true of all the sources that we're concerned about. Usually there's an organizational name that sounds innocuous, Americans for a Better Everything, or some other feeling that tells you nothing about what it is that's behind this particular contribution. And they're very well endowed. They have huge amounts of money. They brought literally tens of millions of dollars into Arizona campaigns.
Anybody bringing in that kind of money has a personal vested economic interest.
Amen. Amen. Mm-hmm. And we know one of them. We just in the last couple of weeks have found out, as we had widely suspected, but it had never been confirmed, that APS, Arizona Public Service, in fact, made a concerted effort to buy two seats on the Arizona Corporation Commission back in 2014.
And the significance of that is the Arizona Corporation Commission sets the rates that they are allowed to charge customers.
Absolutely. It was an investment that paid off. Mm-hmm. $10.7 million is what they've admitted to having spent to get those two commissioners elected. And shortly thereafter, those folks and a few others voted in favor of a $95 million per year rate increase.
That's a pretty good
So it's a great return on your investment, and every year it just keeps clicking over. And we, the ratepayers, are the victims. So if anybody has any doubt that dark money is going to hurt you, I hope that that one—
That's about as tangible an indication, as an example.
It's right there. Yeah, I mean, here it is. Okay. The regulated monopoly utility was able to put some regulators in place who would roll over in their favor and not defend the public. that should be actionable, in my opinion. It's for the commissioners, and it's the kind of thing that we're trying to stop. I mean, by at least telling you the source of the ad that you see on television, not some silly name, mm-hmm. but the actual person or corporation.
Where the money really came from.
Yeah, two things are coming into play, and I think they're very important. Mm-hmm. One, you can evaluate the ad based upon an analysis of the source. And that's really important. I mean, if you're in trial and you've got a witness on the stand, one side is going to say this is the greatest person that ever lived and they're an authority. The other person is going to point out some of the weaknesses in their credentials. Maybe they have a special interest. Maybe not. Maybe there's some error in their training. But the bottom line is you need to know the source of the information. And with dirty money, you never do. You see
– it's the whole point.
Huge amounts and you never know. And the second part is – there's reputational risk. If I'm the company or the individual who has earned the money, and that's how we define the original source, which is what you have to disclose if our constitutional amendment gets into law, that original source has community reputation. They have things that they wanted to defend. I believe, for example, some of the ads that were used in 2014, if APS's name had been at the bottom of them, they never would have run. Because that company needed to keep its reputation alive in the state of Arizona. And they wouldn't do something that basically did character assassination on a black woman, on Sandra Kennedy. But because it was a third party who didn't have reputational risk, who didn't have anything to lose, they went ahead and said the most scurrilous thing they possibly could.
What was it the memo said to say about her? I forget, but it was really...
To attack her credibility, yeah. I think, or imply that she was financially... unscrupulous,
yeah.
And that's what the ads did. They basically made it sound like she was a criminal, that she was a fraud.
It was a personal attack, and it was clearly directed by...
Clearly directed by people at Arizona Public Service. They should be ashamed of it. And if they had actually had their name on those ads, I don't believe they ever would have run, because this was a company that had a community reputation. So I think there are two things. You've got to know so the voter can evaluate the source and be able to make their own decision, yes or no, on what that... that source is trying to tell you. And then second, the source needs to take responsibility. This is about accountability in politics. This is about taking responsibility for your views.
My sense is you've been around here longer than I have, and I've been here a long time. 20 or 30 years ago, APS wouldn't have done this.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there was a major change in their attitude, and I can't speculate as to why, but there were men under Bill Riley, under Keith Turley, under a variety of presidents, Bill Post, that they've had in the past. They were absolute, unequivocal, hands-off of the Corporation Commission. This is not right. A regulated utility should not be involved in the choice of the people that are going to do the regulation. And that was the explicit orders at APS. So something changed, and they went in exactly 180 degrees in the other direction. But they're not the only ones. I mean, although that's the most graphic example that affects
it's
my
clearest,
pocketbook and yours.
It's the clearest one where the quid pro quo is self-evident.
There have been other examples where I think hiding the ball was extremely detrimental to the public decision. In other words, the voters just didn't know what it was that was urging them to go one way or the other. And when you bring hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars in at the last minute in an election campaign, it's going to make a difference. It's going to make a huge difference. And it has in Arizona, which is, unfortunately, number one in the country for dark money coming into our elections and making a difference. In other words, there's more absolute dollars being spent here, and they're having a bigger impact on who gets elected.
We were also the bagman conduit for some California elections.
We were,
money
yeah.
Passed through Arizona.
That's back in 2012. Yeah. Absolutely. Millions of dollars were passed through a bank account here in Arizona from the Koch brothers that ended up in elections all over the country. But I think they've ended up paying a million-dollar fine in California for evading their disclosure requirements.
Yeah.
But Arizona doesn't have disclosure requirements. I think the important thing to know is our legislature is so anxious to please the lords of dark money that they have basically said, oh, if you want to come and play in Arizona, you don't even have to have a political committee. All you have to do is be in good status with the IRS. Well, the IRS doesn't go out and give you or me or anybody else a certificate of good standing. So the law in Arizona calls for something that doesn't exist. And frankly, it says you could spend $10 million, $100 million in Arizona on political ads. And if you're a 501c4 corporation, which most of them are, you don't have to do anything in the terms of disclosure. And that's just wrong. I mean, that's made us the playground for the dirty money operatives.
The thing that really strikes me as the forgotten element of this is we go back to the Citizens United decision that said we can have money is speech and you can have unlimited money. And I remember it was Scalia said, well, what's the remedy? Don't worry about this. The remedy of this is
full disclosure.
Disclosure, and that will take care of it.
Absolutely. And I think I surprise a lot of people because my heroes in this particular legal battle are Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia. They were absolutely outspoken, including in the Citizens United opinion. They said, you know, we think more money is going to be spent in politics because of this decision. We know that. We're not fools. Mm-hmm. They didn't say that in the opinion, but that was the implication. Mm-hmm. But the antidote, the way this is going to be dealt with is the citizens will know where it came from. And just a couple of years ago, before he stepped down from the court, Justice Kennedy said in a really revealing speech to the American Bar Association, he said, you know, I was fooled. I thought the disclosure requirements in this country were far more robust than they actually are. And here in Arizona, of course, what Citizens United did was open the door for corporate contributions, which were illegal before 2010 in Arizona. So all of a sudden, the corporations could spend treasury money on campaigns. They couldn't do it before. And at the same time, they figured out, they have smart lawyers, they figured out that they could hide their involvement by using these 501c4 surreptitious organizations.
Which is a charity.
Supposedly it's a charity. It's under the IRS code, and it means that particular charity doesn't have to disclose its donors. And so all
as long as you have one entity in the chain that doesn't have to disclose, you never get back to the source.
Well, but they have several. I mean, mm-hmm. they immediately developed all kinds of – there's an alphabet soup out there of these organizations, which are – one gives to the other, gives to the other, gives to the other. You know, I was a prosecutor for a long time, and I know a little about money laundering and how illegal funds get laundered so you'll never find out the source. Well, this is money laundering. It's not illegal. I want to make it very clear. But they don't want the citizens to know who it is that spent the original money. So they've got this elaborate money laundering scheme to hide the original source of the political money.
Let me ask a specific point about the APS case. Was there anything in there that, in your opinion, was a violation of the law, or was it just unseemly and going to be rectified by your initiative?
The latter. The challenge for Arizona voters today is that what APS did is perfectly legal, and they could do it again. Or another company could do it again, and they would not break any laws that we have on the books in Arizona. In other words, there's no law against hiding the ball if what you're ultimately doing is legal. So what we've done by not requiring disclosure in this state, which is exactly the law today, is we have basically made ourselves the patsy for any organization that wants to do what APS did or have APS do it again. There is nothing illegal about that. I think it's wrong. But it's not illegal.
Okay. With that point, we're going to bring you back for a final session. Want to change the agenda if we can. As former Attorney General, I want to talk to you a little bit about your observations about the Mueller report when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Terry Goddard. You can put on another hat, former Attorney General. You've read a lot of the Mueller report. You say you've skimmed it all.
I've skimmed it all. I've not read every detail.
But, that's a lot of words.
448 pages. It's a lot of words, a lot of redactions. 10% got, you know, we have not seen yet.
I must say, I read that it didn't seem like the redactions were keeping you from understanding what was being said.
No, I would agree. What I thought was surprising, and it does fly into the face of everything that I know from law enforcement, was when the Attorney General decided to do a press conference before anybody had seen the report.
That was bizarre.
Basically acting as a defense attorney for the president, basically saying, here's what I say it says. Well, okay, that got the beginning of the news cycle, and a lot of people, I think, have assumed, well, if he said it, then it must be true. But the subsequent analysis has shown that many of the conclusions that he reached were simply not supported by the Mueller report. And the most important one was he says they said that there was no chargeable offense, when Mueller says, I think to his credit and appropriately, well, my job was not to make a charge. In fact, the Justice Department has advised me and anybody else who wants to hear it that, in fact, you cannot charge a sitting president. It wouldn't be fair. It wouldn't be possible. So this report lays out the facts for anybody that wants to understand them and potentially take action. But it was never meant to be a charging document. So when the Attorney General says there were no charges, yes, that's exactly what it says. There were no charges because the mandate did not allow that.
And furthermore, he went on to say that if I can't charge him, now, if I were to charge somebody, they get to prove their innocence in court, so right. I can do that. But if I can't charge him, I really can't even accuse him because he doesn't have an opportunity to quote. Right. At right. one point, he says, with respect to whether the president can be found to have obstructed justice by his exercising his powers under Article 2 of the Constitution, we concluded that Congress has authority to prohibit a president's corrupt use of his authority in order to protect the administration integrity of the administration. It seems to me it's an open invitation. It says, Congress, the ball is in your court if you want to deal with that. And it seemed like he felt he was constrained from making a direct accusation.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And there's other language, of course.
And the thing, and this is not a legal analysis, but it is, I guess, a practical one. I listened, as you did, to news attacks, both by Fox News and by the president and many of his spokespeople on Mueller throughout this investigation. Basically, they couldn't possibly reach a good conclusion. They're all Democrats.
Most all Republicans.
And then all of a sudden they said something that was fairly favorable, or at least did not draw the conclusion I guess they were afraid of. And now it's a great thing. So we flipped very quickly in terms of our approval of the report.
I think that was at the moment when the president's office only got inkling as to what Barr's summary would be, not what the Mueller. I do think it seemed to me they did change the narrative. Barr did change the narrative because he says, oh, sees no collusion. The president seized on that. And now as you read through the report, they're already dealing with this headline that's out there.
Yeah.
Which Barr did establish. As if that was the fact. That really was. I mean, the Barr press conference and the four-page memo, that seemed like that's an advocacy paper by Trump's attorney.
Oh, yeah, of course it was. Of course it was. And unfortunately, that's not the role of the attorney general. Yeah. That I've done a number of investigations, and I certainly never tried to poison the well before the investigation was available to the press. You know, let them take a look at it and then answer questions about it. Sure, that's appropriate. But to start out the way he did, I don't think it is. But the other thing, as an American, I mean, I breathe a huge sigh of relief that Mueller, with his credibility and his 2 years of investigation, did not conclude that the president had committed treason, in essence, which was sort of one of the things that we thought might be on the table, that they didn't actively invite the Russians. The Russians were perfectly happy to try to influence the election without collusion with the Trump campaign. And so they went ahead and did it. And I think the lesson for Americans today has got to be, how do we stop that in the future?
They're clearly going to do it again. And they've not only done it in the United States, they've interfered with elections in Western Europe and throughout the world.
Absolutely. And they're good at it. And so what I think we need to do is to put protective barriers around our social media, make sure that the things that happened on Facebook and on other social media sites in the 2016 election can never happen again. And that, unfortunately, the administration has sort of circled the wagons and said, well, we don't want anything to say that somehow our election was tainted or that it may not have been totally legitimate. So we're not going to worry about defensive moves. And I think that's a huge mistake.
As
Americans, we need to be very worried about outside contamination of our elections. And that goes back to dark money.
And I think what people need to understand about that is we're not talking about – there is no evidence that the Russians were able to tamper – with actual votes.
Well, they tried, right. There's no evidence that.
But they polluted the well in terms, and are continuing to do so, in terms of our internal discussions. You don't know on that Facebook post, some of those folks are out of a troll factory in St. Petersburg.
No, you don't. You don't.
And the evidence is there's a lot of them.
And there you have another example of dark money, dirty money, as I call it, because if you don't know who it is that's promoting a particular point of view, don't you think it would be important if you knew it was somebody in Russia that was trying to make you believe or act in a certain way? I know that would be important to Americans and that they would react in a different way. But right now, our laws are so seriously weak and our investigations and our whole attitude toward social media is so laissez-faire that it is easy to pervert the system the way that it's been done. And that's where I think we've got to circle the wagons. The other half of the report had to do with obstruction. And the 10 examples that were laid out of obstruction, frankly, again, as you said, for Congresses and the American people to draw their own conclusions are pretty seriously concerning. I mean, these are our efforts to try to, including trying to stop the report, including trying to fire Mueller, including trying to stop this whole process while it was just getting started. That is obstruction of justice, and I think Congress has got a lot to concern itself with.
I think there's two levels. One is that, and this was the area where he said, you're not exonerated. There's a lot of evidence for here, and then threw it to Congress saying, this is your ball is in your court. But even apart from that, taking away just the strictly legalistic aspect of this, the criminal law appropriately sets a very high bar for proof and what constitutes a crime, as it should. Mm-hmm. But forget about that for a moment. Just look at the ethics and the basic smell of the whole series. You can be unethical and really smarmy without necessarily crossing a legal line. And it's hard to read this without sort of having a yuck factor.
Well, it's sort of the way I was forced to describe APS and their involvement in the 2014 mm-hmm. election. I think it was despicable. I think the Arizona voting public was conned. I think that's wrong. I think that's seriously wrong. But it isn't illegal. So that there is a court of public opinion and there's a court of law. And appropriately, the second has a much higher standard. And I think what Mueller did was try to, in each of those 10 cases, say, well, does this rise to an indictable mm-hmm. offense? And in each case, he thought that it would not, although
which
some of them are dangerous.
Doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of bad stuff in there.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It doesn't mean that there's an exoneration, but there, and hopefully we can learn from it. I mean, for heaven's sakes, if we don't learn from the Mueller report that there are some defensive moves that America should take to protect our democratic institutions, we really are fools.
Do you think we're doing that?
I don't see it right now. Hopefully, outlaw dirty money will be a first step.
Tick, 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 tick. There's an election coming in 2020.
Indeed, there is, and a very important one.
Thank you very much, Terry Goddard.
Thank you,
we'll be
you.
Back next week in the Think Tank. You can find our old episodes archived at ktr.com and the really old ones at mikeoneal.org. See you next week.
The morning lights, the streets that lead them. Time.